Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In the hands of artists and poets, books have taken a radically different form since the advent of the artist books in Paris in the early 20th century. In this episode, Dr. Atif Alsher and Dr. Venetia Porter, art historian and curator of the Artists Making Books, Poetry to Politics exhibition, discuss the accompanying publication, a stunning collection of outstanding and fascinating artist books. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, join us for an enthralling discussion which delves into the range of artists' work from Beirut to Tunis and beyond.
Good morning, everyone. So my name is Alexandra Pringle, and I'm on the advisory board of this wonderful Bradford Literature Festival. I'm so pleased to be back here this year and moderating this event, which is, I think, going to be so interesting. I've had the most amazing week of looking at and reading the book that we're going to be talking about. So I'm going to introduce our really distinguished people who are going to be talking with us. So the first is Venetia Porter, who was the senior curator of Islamic and contemporary Middle East art at the British Museum, and she studied Arabic and Persian and Islamic art at the University of Oxford. Her PhD at the University of Durham is on the history and architecture of medieval Yemen, a country I visited many years ago and adored. She's curated many extraordinary exhibitions, including Hajj, Journey to the Heart of Islam, and she was lead curator at the Al-Bukhari Foundation Gallery of the Islamic World. And she's published a number of books, including this absolutely marvelous book we're talking about today, which is connected with an exhibition which was on at the British Museum, and I'm heartbroken I never got to see in that way that one is with just a few exhibitions in your life. And we have with her Atef Alsher, who is a reader in Arabic studies at the University of Westminster. He grew up in Gaza, a place that's very close to our hearts right now, and was educated at Bezit University in Palestine and at SOAS in London, where he obtained his PhD and taught for several years. He's the author of several publications in the field of literature, language, and politics, and has also published several poems and translations from Arabic poetry into English. And we have here today this book, Out of Gaza, New Palestinian Poetry, which I think everybody will want to have about their person from now on if they don't already have it. So I would like, first of all, for Venetia to tell us what the exhibition was about and what the book is about and how it grew.
Well, thank you for this lovely introduction, and it's absolutely wonderful to be here and to see all of you here. It's lovely. So the book is it's a standalone book, but it accompanied an exhibition at the British Museum, and the exhibition was essentially the collection of these artist books, and we can talk about what is an artist book perhaps later, that are in the collection of the British Museum, and that many of which I was responsible for bringing into the collection. That was one of my roles at the British Museum, along with works on paper by Middle Eastern artists. And I gradually got more and more interested in these books, the way that artists work with poets and so on. And so I was lucky enough to be able to do an exhibition of these wonderful books, which is the exhibition, and this book was my last project really at the British Museum. So it's a subject that I absolutely adore. So it was a great joy doing that. And so this is what this book, this is a subject which people think of artist books as being something just that French or, you know, European or American artists do. But actually there is a world out there of artists from the Middle East and South Asia who make books. And this is what this book is really intended to show, but through the prism of books in the British Museum collection.
But the artist book, am I right in thinking, really properly started in Paris between the wars, and which I think was a very interesting period, because it was a particularly fertile period of conversations between artists and writers, which I think in the West happens very, very little. I think that those two worlds are really separate, and in particular poets and artists.
Yes, so you've got several strands. So you've got this strand, which is the artist book being developed as, exactly as you say, a kind of dialogue between, you know, between artists and poets. And it was two publishers in Paris who kind of started this thing going. And interestingly, one of the earliest Middle Eastern artists, Shafi Aboud, to make books, he studied in Paris, and so he came out of that milieu. But what you have with these works by Middle Eastern artists who work books is they're fusing several different traditions. You know, there's a very strong manuscript tradition in the Islamic world, of course, and then these strong traditions of literature. So with the Middle Eastern artist books, you've got things coming in all different directions, and some of the artists making books now, they may not know of that French tradition. They're just making books because they love them.
Yes, and there is that very strong calligraphic tradition with ancient manuscripts. It seemed to me, looking at the incredible range of countries that these artists came from and poets, that of course there's the unifying themes of, I think, Islam and Arabic as well.
Islam, I think, doesn't necessarily come into it actually very very very but much. I mean, there is
felt it in the background.
It can be there in the background. I think what there is Arabic. Yes, a lot of the books. It's sort of a bit skewed actually, because you know, any collection is skewed really according to what was acquired at any given time.
Yes.
So it is the case that most of the books in the book are by Arab artists, but there is a very strong tradition actually in the Iranian world. In Iran, I discovered actually after doing this that there are loads of Iranian artists making books, and I just didn't know about them. But there are a few in there as well. So you've got the Persian literary tradition coming in there as well.
And what do you think is the specialness about a book rather than a painting or a sculpture? What makes it distinct?
Well, it's very interesting because you get books which are unique, which is just a one-off.
Yes.
Then you've got books made in editions, small editions, or
which you get with lithographs or etchings.
Exactly, yes. But they're in the form of a book. But sometimes the book can be a sculpture, or sometimes it's a book with no words, and sometimes it's a concertina book, and sometimes just a regular open and shut book like that. So I think what's special about them is that you feel they're often very personal. You often get artists who are making oil paintings and all that, but they also make books, and there's a very personal relationship, you know, why they love them. They love them as this kind of 3D personal object. I think in a way that's the specialness of them.
So the intimacy, which is interesting because if you read a novel particularly, or a book of poetry, that the intimacy of that reading experience is a very private experience, which looking at a painting in a gallery is not the same thing.
Exactly. I mean, but the thing is, what you also get, there's a kind of another layer to this, is that some of these are portfolio editions. So they're not bound, and you can actually take them and hang them up on your wall. So you have a different relationship if you're doing this, or if you're actually seeing it. So there's a kind of world out there that's, you know, it's quite different depending on how the artist wanted to make the book.
Yes. So would you like to talk us through the categories, and then we'll then
So essentially it's divided up into these kind of four main sections: this literary heritage, the modern tradition, which is where Atif will come in because there's a lot of poetry. There's something I called histories of the present place and displacement. These are kind of overlapping categories. But in addition to the poetry that we're going to talk about, there are a lot of works which are to do with the contemporary world, with history and politics and migration. You know, there are works which talk about Palestine, which talk about Iraq, and so on. And so those are the four main categories, and we start with the first one is this literary heritage. And so this is just to show you how the book is structured. So you know, there's a text, often a little quotation of poetry, and which just tells you what the chapter is about. And then we start with the Thousand and One Nights.
Yes.
And what interested me about this is of course everyone knows the Thousand and One Nights. And on the left is a beautiful work, which was also this one as well, by Yasmin Seal, who is a who is a translator and a poet herself. And she produced this kind of incredible translation of some of the Thousand and One Nights, first woman actually to do that. But she along with doing the translation, she got interested in the old editions, and she is herself now, she's an artist. And so she started to take these pages from one of the old editions and then turn them into artwork. So I was interested in a kind of juxtaposition between her work there and Jam Ahdawi. Jam Ahdawi is a very well-known Tunisian artist, and he developed this thing called Hurufia, one of a number of artists using script. But you're not intended to read that. So this is a beautiful edition in French where you know, within the pages of the story, you've got this incredible illumination.
Mm. I'm very interested, so that she's the first woman ever, because I was a publisher for many years in my last years at Bloomsbury Publishing, and I published Hanan al-Sheikh's 1001 Nights, and she was asked by the theatrical director Tim Supple to write for a big show he was putting on. And so she rewrote them herself. And it's interestingly the only book she's ever written in English, as she always writes in Arabic. And
so maybe Yasmin is the second, then, not the first.
So, except that it's not really a translation, whereas Yasmin, I think, is a translation. But it's just interesting that the women are claiming those stories. Yes.
I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And so the second section, the modern tradition, I got very interested in this relationship between artists and poets, because I discovered that these artists were not just illustrating the poetry of some of the great contemporary poets like Mahmoud Darwish and Adonis that we're going to talk about in a second. They worked with them, their responses to them. Quite often you find that, and I'll show a couple of cases, you know, where the artists would sit together and they would choose the poems to go into this kind of beautiful edition. So there's something very special about this closeness.
Yes.
And so there's a whole group of it happened within the it was really good to be able to acquire for the collection some of these books. So for example, you know, two great poets of the Arab world, Mahmoud Darwish, an artificer specialist in his work. So he worked with a number of different artists, but what we're going to show one in particular, but then Adonis. I mean, there are something like, I don't know, 10 or 12 books made together with Adonis. So that modern tradition is a very, very interesting one. But, you know, for me, Mahmoud Darwish, the poetry is so incredibly powerful. So, and I was so lucky because Atif and I've known each other for many years, and he'd helped me with translations of some of this poetry which we showed alongside the art some years ago in the British Museum. Mm. And when it came to doing this book, it was help Atif, you know, I can't get quite the right translation, and would you? And so we worked a lot on some of the poems that are in the in the book, and I learnt so much from Atif really about the power of the poetry, particularly of Mahmoud Darwish, I think.
Yes. Atif, would you like to talk a little bit about Darwish?
Well, I must start by thanking you first, but yes, absolutely. Mahmoud Darwish is, as perhaps many of you know, he's a great Palestinian poet, I think the greatest Palestinian poet, and really one of the great Arab poets of the 20th century. He was born in 1941 in the village of Berwe in Palestine, which was destroyed in 1948, and then he lived to Lebanon and came back. It's quite a long story. He came back and then left 1970. He left Palestine to Moscow, Cairo, Beirut, and Amman, and then to Tunis and Ramallah because of the various political developments that were happening. But as far as his poetry is concerned, he comes from that sort of tradition of the 20th century. Was a remarkable, I don't know if you want me to talk about, but it was a remarkable period for Arabic poetry because it was a period of a transformation, particularly in the 1930s and 40s, moving from the formal Arabic, what is called formal Arabic poem, which follows the meter and it's haimistic, to something free verse. And Mahmoud Darwish was one of the leading voices within that movement. It started in Iraq by somebody like Badr Shakir Sayyab, the Iraqi poet Nazik al-Malaika, and then it moved. Mahmoud Darwish took advantage of that heritage and a heritage of the Arabic Qasida, and he was able to sort of transformed the Arabic Qasida into this wonderful echoes of sound, very remarkable sort of composition that is based on the Arabic Qasida, but also very much modern and using the free verse, which is a movement that is starting in France and other countries. So there is that echo of being affected by the European tradition too, but very grounded in the Arabic tradition and Islamic tradition.
He has said, hasn't he, that Rambo and Ginsberg, he's both influenced by Rambo and Ginsberg.
Yes, right? When he was influenced really by T.S. Eliot, by Lorca.
Yes.
Many Arab poets were influenced by Lorca, by they mentioned T.S. Eliot, by Rambo, Nazim Hikmet, but there were very different stages to his poetry.
Mm.
And this particular Kazahr al-Lawza wa Abad, the one that you showed earlier,
yes,
like the Almond Tree or Farther, this is from the from his late poetry, which is about 2007, I think, volume. And it's absolutely remarkable.
Mm.
But I think what is to speak to this particular theme of the connection between the word and the image, what Arab poets, particularly somebody like Darwish, Adonis, and others have provided is to provide this wealth of insight, of imagery that is quite remarkable, quite original, and it sort of amalgamates and contains different tradition. And therefore, artists such as the ones that you've looked at and you've included remarkably in your book, they have taken advantage of this sort of a new language, so as to say, or a new discourse, a new poetic discourse, in a way that is unprecedented, because you have somebody like Darwish, you know, who does somebody like that doesn't come often. So there's that incredible sort of benefit from the Adonis on the one hand and Darwish, because of just the newness of the exhibition that is spoke to the time and to the conditions of, sorry, I have this bad cough, to the conditions of the Arab world and Palestine, and there's so many developments, political developments that were happening. And also there were poets who were very aesthetically minded. They wanted to be read internationally. They wanted to speak to human conditions worldwide. They wanted to be read. And therefore, the visual aspect was very, I would guess, is very appealing to artists. And this is where...
But this one, for example, is one of the ones that you translated. So from Mahmoud Darwish's Qasida Beirut. So this is from the time when he was in Beirut.
Yes.
And before, so before 82, he was there for a long time, wasn't he? And then they
yes.
had to leave. But what it was really interesting working with you on this. Well, you were doing the working. I wasn't. I was just writing the notes, you know. But this, I mean, there's, I don't know if you can all see the words, but there is an incredible sort of simplicity of language. And
yes.
then that amazing refrain, you know, Beirut our tent, Beirut our star. And so this
yes.
is... This is a work by Rashid Qureshi. So he worked with Mahmoud Darwish
yes.
when they got to Tunis. But he makes these works like this. So that actually unbelievably has the poem there in Arabic. But he writes kind of backwards and forwards and roundabout and you know all of that. So
and
then he helps. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry.
No. It's just.
This is also a song, actually.
Is it?
It's a very beautiful song by Mursel Khalifa. It's sung quite... But the significance of this poem, because the Palestinians, as you know, from 1970 after Amma, after Jordan, they went to Beirut and stayed from 1970 as the political movement. I mean, the BLO and Darwish was there. So this Beirut at that time, as you know, was a hub of Arab culture, poetry. Adonis was there. So many of them were there. So Beirut really provided that incredible cultural literary cover, which served many artists. And that's why this kind of lament and love
it's
for Beirut.
Such a beautiful poem, isn't it? It's absolutely extraordinary, I think.
Yeah. What were the challenges for you, Atif, like in translating this? I mean, is he a difficult poet to translate?
Actually, Darwish is not. I mean, there's no, because Arabic has its own rhythm, its own, it is good, its own energy. A logic, but actually Darwish, because his the sentence structure is quite clear. So in that sense, sometimes Darwish, the imagery sometimes could be a bit odd in English, but the poetry of Darwish actually, and particularly later in the later stages, become much clearer, much simpler, that it can be translated and can be read and can be understood worldwide. But there's nothing obviously like the Arabic, but it's an attempt. So I think translating Darwish's, I mean, I didn't translate many of Darwish's poems, I translated some. Mm. And because I just loved his poetry, and I mean, when I read Kazahr al-Lawzi or Abad, like the Alam and the Tree or Father, I didn't know if it was translated or not. I just went on and translated the whole volume just because for the sheer love of it. Mm. So I thought that will bring me closer to the words if I start to engage with it at such a level. Mm. And with this poem, the beautiful poem, beautiful imagery, and also it speaks to me as a Palestinian, Gaza, Beirut, Lebanon, the conditions resonate. And therefore I feel that sort of, that closeness to the words and to the conditions.
I think we should talk a bit about Adonis.
Yes.
Those are the two, you know, lodestars. And later we'll talk more about relationship between poets and politics. But I think it's very, very, very interesting that Darwish's 66 poem, wasn't it, to my mother, really became a kind of anthem for Palestine, that there are, that poets can produce the words that are closest to people, you know, at times of struggle, through years of struggle. And didn't he read a poem called Identity Card?
Yeah.
In a cinema, is that right, in Nazareth?
Well, that was not, Identity Card was after, it was in 1968.
Yeah.
So it was within the sort of, after the 1967, the military rules that Israel imposed on the Palestinians until that time were very strict. Mm. And they wanted sort of Arabs within Israel, Palestine. They didn't want to show them, to show any sign of Arabness or Palestinianness. So that came as a sort of a defiant poem to tell about the Arab Palestinian minority that remained within what became Israel. So that sort of definitional poem. But the other poem, Ila Ummi, Hanu Ila Khubzi, I long to my mother's bread and my mother's coffee, etc. That actually he wrote in a prison, inside the prison when he was in Akka prison. And he wrote it on papers, on cigarette paper, you know, and then smuggled it and it became a song. He was very surprised that it became a song. A very, very well-known song in that.
It's, I think the thing of songs, there's in 80s Pakistan, there was a particular poem by Faiz Ahmed Faiz, yes, that was, their singer wore a black sari to sing it. And it was, and then you were not allowed to wear saris because it was, the country was being Islamicized. And she was called Iqbal Banu, and she wore this black sari and she sang it on television. And it had the most extraordinary effect. So there you have, again, you have artists and poets, we have poets and song, and, yeah, and the power of that, don't you? And then she was banned.
Yeah.
So it was out.
I need to, I don't, do you want me to move to?
Yes, please. Yes.
So there he is on the bottom right, working with an artist actually called Himmat, who's Iraqi, and they've made a lot of books together. And so Adonis there, he's writing on one of Himmat's works, which will become a book. And then Adonis, having worked with so many poets, he started making art himself, and I think it's because he thought artists were having all the fun. So he started making these works with kind of collage and things. And what's really nice about this one is that you see his hand. So in a lot of the, he's got the most beautiful writing hand. And so some of the artist books actually reproduce the way he wrote that. So
and then that's collage with textile.
So he's got, little bits of textile he seems to have sort of stuck on. It's very intriguing work, this one.
Yeah.
And he wrote the poem of a very early Arab poet as well. So Adonis, I mean, we were talking about Sufism and Adonis is like so strongly rooted in that. So these were a couple of books connected to Sufism in the book.
No, I mean, Adonis, I mean, in my book poetry, I don't want to market my book poetry and politics in the Arab world, but there's a chapter where I compare and talk about Darwish and Adonis, because it's actually quite a remarkable sort of vision for what poetry is. And Adonis comes from that tradition, or I think particularly later when he left Syria in 1956, where he saw poetry as sort of about language, about spirit, about renewal, and it's not particularly tied to political events or particular situations or conditions, and that poetry doesn't necessarily speak to politics, it speaks to the human spirit, to the eternal human spirit, as perhaps he would call it. So they're quite different poets, and I think Adonis's incredible journey, I mean, I think he was born in 1935, I think in Qassabin or something around that time. He's in his 90s now, and he hasn't stopped since that, you know, since he was a very young boy when he met the president of Syria, Shukr al-Qawtali or something, in the 1950s, read a poem for him, asked him for a scholarship, which he gave him a scholarship to study. And then they asked him to be conscripted in the Syrian army, and he fled to Beirut. And this is where he found his voice, and he did his PhD on what's called the Thabit wal-Mutahawwil, the fixed and dynamic in Arabic culture. And his poetry from that sort of, and then he put together the Arabic tradition in four volumes, the most significant poets and so on. But his voice through Sha'r, the Majallat al-Sha'r, is quite different, his vision, to that of Darwish. Darwish was very tied to the Palestinian struggle till the end, although actually his voice developed and he always wanted to write poetry that speak to the human condition, as it were, whereas Adonis doesn't want poetry to be dealing with politics. Mm-hmm. And this is where Majallat al-Sha'r came in. And he was deeply, you mentioned Sufism. Sufism definitely was one of the main strands that influenced Adonis. And he wrote a very remarkable Sufiya wa Surrealiya, Sufism and Surrealism, and also in the Introduction to Arabic Poetics, remarkable account of how Arabic poetry somehow in the past, particularly in the medieval, like Amr ibn Abi Rabi'a and other poets, how that poetry itself was modern. He said, when I read like Baudelaire, Charles Baudelaire in France, I discovered the Arabic, how modern the Arabic tradition that I discovered Arabic poetry. So Adonis has this, what we call chathat, yani, sort of wanderings and remarkable insight, and but very different poet than Darwish. And it's amazing that he turned to art as well, to writing, because he believed, I think, in renewal. And I think he saw that sort of fusing imagery, that sort of imagery, working with artists, including his own handwriting, as a kind of a spiritual renewal to the individual doing it and to the one seeing it as well.
But the poems have become very iconic, some of them. I mean, this is an interesting one. This is another one that you kindly translated here. So this is the Lebanese artist Shafi Aboud. I mentioned him. He's the first Middle Eastern artist to make books. But what's interesting to me about it is that he's an abstract artist, but he's written the words in his own. At what you see is Shafi Aboud's handwriting there, and the poem itself is very, very beautiful. I mean, in terms of translating Adonis, I'm so interested in this process of translating, but, you know, in terms of translating Adonis, which you did for this one, I mean, does that, because I know there were lots of words that you were going backwards and forwards to find the right echo.
Yeah, Adonis is quite different to but I think what fascinated me about the Adonis is this sense of, it's a bit strange to say this, but Adonis is always looking for something new. Like his poetry is all about what he called beginnings, bidayat, awwal al-tariq, the beginning of the road, and creating something new. His poetry is very much, some of it is almost untranslatable, but some of it does translate. And this poem, any one of the poems that did work well, I think, and I think it's beautifully also represented in this artwork too.
Mm. Mm. So this is and the next one, they're from Qabr, New York, I think this one is.
Yes,
which was a very powerful work, poems. So was this where he went to America and he saw this racism in America and he just, there was some story.
Yes, Harlem, yeah. I think this one, a few Arab poets got into the habit of being influenced by Lorca. Because Nueva poem is the New York.
And what do you think it was about Lorca that
He was saw the racism in America. He saw the discrimination, and they sort of took after him. Many Arab poets, Darwish wrote about that in his poem. Francine Goodwood Said, living in New York, is talking about the segregation. But Adonis came, and he wrote this poem a bit earlier. I think it was about 60s, 70s sort of poem. So he wrote it being, and also Adonis was very opposed to this hyper-modernism that he saw in New York, the tall buildings. He saw it as something bit jarring to the senses. The concrete, so he saw as he saw it as qabr or as Darwish, and Darwish also saw the city as this hyper modernism again as something that didn't appeal to him. So it was a critique of the city and the way this American civilization that is affecting the Middle East, destroying parts of the Middle East as it is doing in Gaza and Palestine more broadly. And when they saw the devastation of Beirut and the American support to Beirut, so they saw this civilization which is modern, and somehow there is the political element of criticizing it, and that it's destroying the ancient world or the old world, which is, in their view, gave them all this poetry and sort of beginnings of humanity and civilization and so on. So there was that contrast of New York as a center of financial center, a center of segregation as well, blacks and whites and civil rights movement, and also as a place that is affecting the Middle East, which is gave birth to such remarkable civilizations and poetry.
So this is the wonderful poet, artist Diel Azawi, who is the most remarkable Iraqi artist, has lived in London since the 1970s. So he's somebody who makes paintings, sculptures, but also who has completely made the book his own. There was an exhibition in Oxford a while ago.
Modernity about his
absolute modernity. Yes. And he's somebody who inspired actually a lot of his fellow Iraqi artists who were in the in Iraq in the 90s with sanctions, and some of these artists were contacting him and saying, look, we can't get our art out, we can't get materials out, and so he said to them, make books. And and I've talked to some of these artists, and they said, but when Dia said to us, make books, we didn't know what he meant, like sketchbooks or what. He said, no, make books.
Real books.
And so a lot of them did, in fact. And there is now a whole genre. They call them dafatir, so using the Arabic word for like notebook. And so this is now a genre of the artist book. But only Iraqi artists, and a lot of them are using poetry, but they're also talking about the destruction of Iraqi heritage and so on. Diaz, the one who started this.
How wonderful.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
I felt resonances of Picasso through the whole book in some way, in Picasso's relationship, Picasso shifting in the way that he worked, and his constant modernity, but also his relationship to artists around him and poets particularly. And I sort of felt his spirit, and his politics dancing through this book in some way. It's interesting.
I'm happy to move us along, because I was also intrigued. There are other artists. So this is Kavafi, and this is a wonderful thing. This is an artist, Egyptian artist, modernist, lives in New York, I think now, and he lived in. He's from Alexandria, so he felt a terrific affinity for Kavafi, and actually he describes how he picked up a copy of Kavafi in the old market in Alexandria, and then he started to translate the Kavafi into Arabic, and then created this kind of these beautiful drawings, wonderful, which are echoing. So Kavafi, you must have read Kavafi, just so such a powerful.
Kavafi has deep influence on many Arab poets. I think particularly the theme of longing for a city, and being in exile. That's sort of theme.
That is in your last section, I think.
Yes.
But we should go. Yes, we'd love you to talk about that.
Yes. I'm going to move on. Where shall I move us to? should just keep.
Oh, I love this so much. This.
Yes. Do you want me to talk about that?
No, not necessarily. I just love this image.
Yes. Yes. This is an. I'll just say very quickly. This is an Iranian artist. Lives in the States, and he loves books, and so he started reading Asimov and getting into all this kind of futuristic literature. And so he decided to use this technique called cyanotype, which is these ferrous metals that you paint on the on the paper, and he exposed them to the stars. So that's why you've got all these dots. But anyway, there's lots more to say about that. It's beautiful. There's something about that blue that is so extraordinary. Yeah. So I'm not going to talk about them because you want to get into
It would just be lovely to talk about each section of the book a bit.
Okay, so I think I can't remember which section this is in. I think this must be in the displacement or the...
Okay, so should we...
Well, yes, of course, the politics.
Should we go into what's the chapter three in the book? And I mean, both chapter two and chapter three are sort of talking to each other, but a little bit more about poetry and politics and how this comes into the book, because I think particularly at the moment with what is happening in Gaza, that the fact that poets are being targeted, but the voices of poets are so important at the moment. And Mossab Abu Toha, is his extraordinary poems right from the kickoff from October the 7th onwards became what certainly everyone I knew, we were all looking to see what he was writing, and then he managed to get into Egypt. I saw that he's now in America, that yesterday or the day before he moved there. But it would just be interesting to talk about sort of poets in this situation of war and resistance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Arabic poetry is, particularly the modern period, is just an extraordinary journey. And I think in Gaza, you mentioned Gaza, I think I've documented two or translated two poets who sadly were killed by Israeli bombardment, Nada, Hiba Abu Nada, and Rifat al-Arayir. And not long time ago, also Osama Nofel was also killed with his family. So I think it's just there is an attempt to kill the brains of Gaza, the culture of Gaza, in addition to the doctors, anybody who can make anything, who have a voice, they target. And Darwish himself, we go back in time, Darwish was throughout his 20s, and today in prison, tomorrow out of the prison. He was in and out of the prison all the time. So there is an attempt to completely destroy the Palestinian voice, in addition to sort of not allow them to permit, to allow them to narrate their story. And we see this also in this volume. We talk about poets who have been oppressed and the way they turned that oppression into poetry as refugees, which you document in your book very well. And I think the Palestinians have been their heritage since 1930s. In the other book, A Map of Absence, I documented their poetry from the 1930s to the present time. This is what is available to them, language, in the face of this enormous power, in fact, powers. The US, Europe, that are giving Israel the weaponry to destroy Gaza now and to destroy Palestine. What is available to them is language, and I think they have used it extraordinarily well. And Mossab Abu Toha come from that, you know, in his book so many times he references Edward Said, Mahmoud Darwish, Ghassan Kanafani, Fadwa Tawqan, and other Palestinian poets. But obviously they are a target. Anybody with a voice is a target. And it's, I don't know what to call it, just pure evil, really.
And of course, that has always happened to poets. I mean, I think of my friend Joseph Brodsky, who was sent to a labor camp, you know, in Russia. And of course, there are cultures where people are much closer to poetry than in others. I mean, in Britain, I don't think, you know, most people have a close relationship with poetry, but in Russia, everybody does, you know, and you can learn them by heart. And so if you're living in a certain kind of regime, it's a way of expressing yourself and the plight of people who are around you. But when I traveled in Iran, I was very struck by how close the relationship that people had with poetry there. And I think that this is very much in terms of this exhibition and this book, that you feel that all the way through, don't you?
You do. And then also, I've just put on the screen here, so it's also artists who yes. are communicating that condition. And I think for me, this yeah. book is just completely emblematic of what's going on. I mean, this is Palestinian artist, not from Gaza, but Khalil Rabah. And this is a book he calls the like dictionary work. So what he did was that he took an English dictionary and he highlighted the word, the definition of Philistine. So you know, it came into the vocabulary. It's kind of racist, you know, right from the beginning when it started entering vocabulary. What is a Philistine? You know, somebody who hates culture and, you know, etc. And so he's just left open that. Well, yes. then the rest of it is nails. And if anybody's actually tried to put a nail into a block of paper or anything like that, it's really hard. So when you hold this book in your hands, which is a dictionary, you really feel that, you feel the pain. And so artists as well as poets are communicating.
And there are artists, I mean, the countries that have covered the conflicts, the Algerian War of Independence, the India-Pakistan partition, you know, a lot of responses to the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, there are so many conflicts that are there, but expressed in these beautiful ways.
Exactly. I mean, this for example, this just takes us back to the Dafatir in sense. So this is Mahmoud Abedi. So what he talks about is that, you know, he was forced to move at a certain stage, and he was constantly moving, and then he was constantly losing everything. And so he decided that actually he was only going to keep what he wanted just in sort of in one suitcase. And then he started making these books, which are like suitcases. So so he finds this like a little metal rusty suitcase. Conservation Department went mad when I was trying to bring this into the collection, of course. Anyway, but inside this box is a book. So it's got kind of scraps of thoughts and things, and he calls this compact home. So this way in which, you know, these artists are communicating, I think it goes back to your first question, which is what is special about them?
Yes.
When you see this, all of them, they are about a relationship.
Yes.
And this is very obviously Mahmoud's relationship with being an Iraqi, what it is to be an Iraqi, in the way that the Khalil Rabah is what it is to be a Palestinian.
Yes, yes. And that brings us on to the sort of final section, which is, you know, the whole theme of place and displacement and exile. And I recently read Hisham Attar's new novel, which I think is a masterpiece about exile. And there is something about exile that is different from immigration. It's different from almost every other kind of displacement, I think. And the longing and the sadness that's in it is almost unbearable.
It is unbearable. And what
his wife, of course, is.
Yes, Diana. So Diana Matar, you know, was extraordinary, is a wonderful photographer. And she went with Hisham when he was able to go back. And
this was after his father, who disappeared when he was a child, and they never knew what happened to him for years, did they?
Exactly. Yeah. And so she what she's interested in is documenting places where something happened. And so she it's an amazing work. This is called Evidence. And so she goes to places where something happened, or in this case, it's where there was a wall with pictures of the disappeared. And it's a very, very powerful work. I can just leave this one maybe because it's...
Yes.
Because where I think we're...
And we need to go, exactly. Let's see if there are any questions. If we could have some light up so that we can see the audience. Flick. And there is a...
As you're thinking, I can just show a few of these.
Yes.
Fadi Yazici.
And there's a mic.
Just want to mention this one. This is Mohamed Shonu, who's a Saudi artist, brilliant Saudi artist. And those of you who are going to the talk on the Islamic Arts Biennale, which is at 2:30, he's one of the curators for that. So he made this exquisite book. It's absolutely tiny, and it is about place and displacement. It's actually two little figures. So depending on which way you open it, it either starts as one, and then he's joined by he or she is joined by another. And then, or if you open it from the right, it's two people, and then there's a loss in the middle. It's most exquisite. And he makes his own paper and stains it and so on. So, and this is the last slide. Anyway, this is the Turkish artist, İpek Dübenen. This is Refugee. It's the most powerful book. So she took pictures of newspaper cuttings from refugees from all over the world, and then she printed them onto this kind of like a synthetic gauze and embroidered them over. So the material is very, very delicate, but the story is so it's incredible sort of contrast between the delicacy of the material and then the power. almost. Mm.
I remember, suddenly remembered there was at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, there was an exhibition of a Palestinian artist, American Palestinian artist, who went to displaced Palestinians and said, I'm going to go there. What is the one thing you would like me to do? And so somebody asked to go and visit their mother's grave, and she took a photograph of it, and, you know, or drink a cup of coffee in a particular bar. And it's an absolutely extraordinary journey that you go on. I remember I just chanced on it going around these walls. So it shows so much the power of art with these things. Okay, does anyone have anything that they would like to, any questions?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for a fascinating presentation for everybody. This is a question, I hope it's not too off the wall, Venetia, but I was going to ask about the genres. You know, one that I imagine might have started with people doing themselves at home is pop-up books. I also want to ask about graphic novels, if you've encountered either of those genres in your researches.
Well, no, it's a very interesting question. Thank you. So I haven't seen any pop-up books, actually, but I know that, I mean, in the British Library, they are beginning to collect, for example, graphic novels. And also there's a whole other category, which is where books were being produced in Beirut and Cairo, but often the cover is made by an artist. And so you've got that relationship there. And I think this is material very much that Daniel is interested in acquiring for the collection, yeah, of the British Library.
Curator, I mean, the British, yes, Library, I found that collecting graphic novels from Turkey, for example, became a must.
Yes. You know, so you were doing that.
Cultural area doesn't covered by other kind of books.
Thank you. It's very interesting, the growth of graphic novels in the last 10 years, that they've become so much part of our culture. And so seriously so, I think. So very interesting. Just in the meantime, but do think of anything you'd like to ask. I'm very interested in textiles, and I was interested that textiles were used in some of these. And I went to that, it was an extraordinary exhibition at Kettle's Yard in Cambridge of Palestinian clothing, yes, and how often messages were embroidered into those extraordinary, unbelievably beautiful things, but how much textiles can transmit. And I was very interested in how they were used in some of these.
Yes, books. I mean, that was a very, very important exhibition, Material Power,
yes,
at Kettle's Yard, which then went to the Whitworth. I don't know if you saw it, Atta, but it started its life in the Palestine Museum in Brazil. And what's actually very important about those textiles is they are completely about identity. And so, you know, each village has its own set of, you know, embroidery, you know, designs and that sort of thing. And then during the course of the first Intifada, I think it was, you know, women started to embroider, you know, motifs, flags and all, yes, of that. And actually the curator, Rachel Dedman, said a very beautiful thing about those, is that we think of resistance, you know, we go out on demonstrations or whatever, something very quick. But, you know, she said that embroidery is very slow.
Yes.
And this is a very slow resistance. And it kind, yes, of, she equates it with this sabr. The prickly pear is called, yes, the, you know, sabr, this patience, you know, that it's, as it were, the long view.
Yes.
And it's, yes, a very, very beautiful exhibition.
Knowing that this is something that you're looking,
exactly,
at, such a long thing.
Exactly.
It's not a quick,
exactly,
a quick thing. There's an artist who's got a show on here at the Cartwright Hall, which I really recommend. He's called Osman Yousefzadeh. He's actually talking about his book. I'm talking with him about that this afternoon, because he wrote this extraordinary memoir about growing up in Birmingham in the most deprived background. And he ended up going to SOAS and becoming a clothing designer and an artist. But his art is increasingly about his childhood and his mother, who was a seamstress, and she was in Pada and was really not allowed out at all. And he uses embroidery and textile in his work. And this exhibition is about the immigrant experience, but it's all connected with the women and the use of textiles. I think it's very interesting. And I was very interested that some of the books here.
Yes. There's the Adonis, and yes, so textiles. There's
an Iranian.
I know the one you were talking about, Mohammed Zeeshan.
Yes.
So Mohammed Zeeshan is a Pakistani artist, and he comes from this very interesting, really, context where there's a school in Lahore where they've been teaching the traditional techniques of painting and illumination and all of that, but in a very contemporary way. So these artists like do their own paper. It's called Wasli paper, and so he's made a book which is in the book there, which looks like it's embroidery, but it's the flag. So he does this very clever thing where he draws these flags, so they look like embroidery, but which are all the flags of all the countries that have had some kind of probably rather complex relationship with America, basically. So it's very quite stark in that way. But look at them; they're so beautiful, and they do exactly. Because when I first saw this book, I thought, oh, these are threads that are there, but it's not. So that relationship is absolutely right.
I think one of my great passions is Pakistani embroidery. It's from the Swat Valley in particular, the Pukhari, and they hold so much in them, and there's some of them, they're works of art, and yet they are part of people's everyday lives. So there's cushion covers, and you know, it's when art and ordinary life combine. I think it's really interesting. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you so much for such a lovely exhibition. I was just wondering, you mentioned about in the 90s how the artist book came out of Iraq, of the way of getting art out of Iraq during the sanctions. And I was wondering if you have noticed similar kind of innovative genres of getting art and poetry out of Gaza since October, or if you envision similar kind of innovation to get.
Well,
art.
I think that, I mean, it's a very important question. I mean, there are, you know, artists will probably know more, but I mean, just quickly to say that there are some very important artists from Gaza. One thing that people often don't know about Gaza is the richness of the artistic institutions, which, as Atif has said, have been systematically destroyed. And you know, you think of the Rashid Shawa, and there are many other of these institutions that had extraordinary artists and artists from Gaza. You know, because they would. Working in such difficult circumstances that they couldn't get out. You know, it's often said that artists from Gaza have something very particular to them. Often they're using like new materials and doing very imaginative things. And we've seen, I forget the name of this artist who it was featured in. Well, there's Malak Matar, who did very interesting things, but there's somebody who produces a drawing every day. And The Guardian featured. And so I think in the future, I think we're going to see a huge amount of art coming out of Gaza in the way that they can now.
Yeah. I think since this current genocide, that there has been lots of poems posted on Facebook and social media in general. And for example, Rifat al-Ariri's poem, the one that is got around, If I Must Die, was written just 2 days before he was killed. And it was posted online
and
on social media.
And Brian Cox reading it.
Yes. Exactly.
And that went viral.
Yes. Went viral. But I think at the moment, the situation in Gaza is actually, there have been a lot of people who are writing on the tents, because most Gazans are on tents now, if they have a tent. So there's been lots of artistic creation and
on tents,
and actually even in music, because all the centers of culture have been destroyed in Gaza. The universities have been destroyed. Many artists have been killed. It's just really a decimation of the cultural wealth. And a museum that housed some amazing objects from Greek time up to the present has all gone. The embroidery one has also gone. So there's quite a lot of things that are, but I think women, actually, there's women coming together in Rafah. Now they've gone to Khan Yunis, but they were in my city, Rafah. And they were embroidering clothes, not for art, but it is art somehow, this embroidery. And there was some therapy session through embroidery. But I was going to say, music, for example, they are using very, what do you call it, like a tube, you know, like water pipe, and turning it into a flute. What is it? This flute? Is it
recorder.
So they're using whatever very basic tools that are available to them to make art. And then there's also lots of dancing sessions for children in schools where they have also been targeted because Israel regards the UNRWA as a terrorist organization too. So I think people actually, if you've looked at so many videos and seen so many scenes where art is actually essential for their survival as we speak, since 7th of October and before, because, and many of the people who are guiding them, you know, leaders, young leaders, they're trying to focus on art because that's a way to survive day to day. So, yes.
It shows the importance of culture, you know, in all our lives. Yeah, okay, one more question, then we need to wrap up.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting. I'm wondering if you have any collections or you know anything about artist books aimed at children.
Aimed at children? No, I mean, of course, like, there are lots of books.
Picture books, but I mean, like, as kind of a more, maybe more political or more nuanced or more cultural kind of transmission to, like, the younger generation is better.
I don't know of any, but of course, there are wonderful children's books. I mean, I think even in this festival, there's definitely somebody talking. I've forgotten the name of the person who's written a children's, an artist book.
There is one called The Thing. Dabashi lady, I can't remember. She's the daughter of Hamid Dabashi. I mean, Leila Dabashi. She wrote Beep for Palestine. It's very, very graphic book,
okay.
And it's very
for
artistic
children.
And it's for children.
There
and actually, there are a few others that came out recently, but I forgot the name of all them. But it's a growing genre, I think.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's an artist, that artist books per se, or, I mean, it's, you know, it's been difficult to describe exactly what is an artist book, of course, but you know, generally we think of them as what I spoke about before. But these are like illustrated books for children. So Peace for Palestine. I mean, but it's
whereas
fantastic.
Whereas artist book tend to be like a one-off or...
It's either a one-off or... And it's where the
artist... So they don't have that availability.
But that's really interesting. Maybe that's something to be encouraged, absolutely.
So we've run out of time now, and I really recommend this book. It is absolutely beautiful, and it gives you so much to think about, and the combination of the beauty of the words and the beauty of the images is a very, very powerful thing. And I also hugely recommend this book. So it just remains to say thank you so much to Artef, and thank you so much to Venetia.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.